Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Thanks for listening to CarCast on Podcast One.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.
Hey, man, before we get started with CarCast, let me tell you about Amazon Automotive. Shop auto parts, tools, accessories quickly and easily. Do it from your phone, do it from your computer, do it from your tablet. Plus, free shipping on millions of items for Prime members. Massive selections of parts, accessories, tools, fluids, even tires. This I did not know. I knew all this other stuff, like they have top brands like K&N and Bilstein, Chemical Guys, Bosch, and more, but I didn't know tires. Smart Amazon, so smart. Tired of looking up part numbers, reading catalogs with Amazon? All you need is the year, make, and model, and you're off and running. Use customer Q&A and product reviews to research and buy the right part the first time. So go to Amazon.com/auto deals. That's Amazon.com/auto deals. Start your shopping today. Amazon Automotive. All right, let's get going with the show. Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get on mandate. Get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. We love that about you. Over here at CarCast, I'm Matt Corral. It's Matt, the moderator, DeAndrea.
Hello.
Well, I still got my cold, so my voice is a little wanky. Steve Saleen is coming in. World famous Steve Saleen. You know all about him. I know all about him. Matt knows all about him. He's going to be introducing a new ride, right?
Yeah, we saw it at the LA Auto Show. It looks great. I'm excited to talk a little bit about that with Steve.
He hasn't been here since 2009. He came in on CarCast like first year.
The now, of course, the 7, the S7.
Yeah.
Those are now, I see them around at auctions and stuff now. Those are fetching good prices. Yeah, I love expensive. Those things in race trim. And then also, I seem to remember that there was a kind of rent-a-racer aspect to this. I remember a friend of mine who worked on the Man Show, came in from New York. I think he rented a Saline Mustang back in the day, like in the late 90s, something like that. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, we got to ask Steve about that. And you mentioned the S7. There's some news about that as well, because that car has an incredible racing history, very prominent winning racing history. So we want to...
So we'll bring Steve in and a couple of few. Before that, what's going on in your world, Matt?
You know, I'm kind of looking forward to this little break we're getting on, because now I can get back into the garage and working on the Mustang. And you saw I was doing a little painting on the firewall.
Yes, unventilated. I walked in yesterday and Matt was spraying away.
We had just started.
Yeah, so I said...
And then I was like, we should open the door. Then you were like, we should open the door.
No, I was like, put the fan in the goddamn door, like I tell everyone all the time. There's always this weird thing with the fan. The fan has there are things that are weird, like corded wise. Like the big fan, the big circular fan has a cord on it. It's like 5 foot.
Yeah, if that.
A hairdryer has a 6 foot cord, but the fan has a 5 foot cord. And there's always an outlet that's kind of close enough, but not quite.
Not quite.
You have to put it at a weird angle, but it still is going to work. But if you had an extension cord, you could put it wherever you wanted, but it's not worth getting the extension cord.
It needed just like another 12 inches of cord. It needed like another foot, and then it would be perfect. Like, it wedges right near the door.
Why not put a 12-footer on the big industrial fan?
You know, Like, what are you concerned about? Extra weight? Because that's
no. It's a non-issue. Freight Harbor. Wait a minute. Harbor Freight would have to charge you another 81 cents.
Yeah.
That's why they don't do it. Yeah.
So it'd be $7.81 for that giant fan.
Right. So Matt was chipping away philosophically. Yeah. It's a good idea. Matt's got the right plan. He chips away. That's what most people I know who are losers in general, but also losers in the project department, they just don't chip away. They sit around and the project goes untouched for months and weeks and years. And at some point when you ask them about it, they go, I'm getting ready to make a run at it. And you go, well, why don't you just hit it for a couple hours every weekend? Time passes quickly. I'll bet you'll get a lot done. And they're like, no, I'm gonna make a run at it. Like, I'm going to get some dudes, and we're going to get a running start.
The problem with that is a lot of times you run into, you're going to need parts. So if you start chipping away on a weekend, then you're like, okay, now I know what I need. And you make your order, you get it in a week, you know. And so then you can get back on it again because you got the parts ordered. So, but one of the things we finished up, I think it was last weekend or so, which I thought was pretty cool, was the Mustang, the 93 Mustang, has a straight steering column. It's not tilt because it was the first year with the airbag or the second year with the airbag. Mm-hmm. And when it had the giant airbag in it, they couldn't figure out how to do a tilting wheel, you know, with that. So
really?
I lowered.
I feel like that.
They had a tilt column in 89, and then when they switched to like 90 and 91, and they had, you know, the earlier ones, like 87 or 89, had like a tilt column, and then when they put the airbag in, they couldn't figure out tilt. Mm-hmm. You know, for some reason, I don't know. So I've always wanted to lower the steering column. So I unbolted the steering column from under the dash. I added some spacers. I replaced some of the bolts, used all my own hardware, and I lowered the thing a little bit. But through the firewall, when you lower the steering column in the car, when it passes through the firewall, that part of the steering column raises a little bit because your pivot point is basically the steering, like the firewall.
Right.
Right?
Right.
That caused the U-joint on the steering coming off the firewall to hit the header. Mm-hmm. And I have aftermarket headers. They're 1 3/4 inch. They're bigger tube header. And I tried all sorts of things to try to make it to work, and I didn't want to be the guy that bangs on that header again and heats it up and bangs it up and heats it up and bangs
it. Puts a dent in it to make room.
You know, so we came up with a solution where I'm running a U-joint off of the firewall,
mm-hmm.
and then it goes to a two-piece shaft, and we added off of the K-member, we welded a support bearing, like a Heim joint, a rod end.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes through that, and then another U-joint, and then another U-joint. And now it steers super smooth. There's just a slight, it almost looks like it's still straight, but there's just a slight little bump out, you know, where it goes. And it's, now it's great. Now I can see why nobody lowers the steering column because of the issues with it.
Right.
You know, it was a back and forth of getting the right pieces and getting the right U-joints and cutting the shafts down and making them work. And it was probably overkill, but now it works and it's going to be comfortable to drive. And off the K-member, we just welded that support bearing and it worked out great. Shot a little black paint on it. Now it's perfect. So it's a cool little trick.
So Matt just shows up at the shop and sort of just saws away. You just sort of chop wood all day. People really have no idea how that's the key to life, that they never really work that part of life out. Everybody I know, you know, when you want to make a documentary or an animated short or you want to build your kid a treehouse or whatever it is, it's just that. All of life is that. Now, the stuff you can accomplish in 10 minutes isn't really the stuff worth talking about or having or whatever. Yeah. That's why people, you know, when they're showing off their car, they're really just showing off their attitude. You know, I got X amount of hours into this. It took me 3 years to build.
Yeah.
I did the blah, blah, blah myself. Nobody shows off a car and goes, I did it and took me about 90 minutes. So
right.
Enjoy. Like, it's all about, it's why, you know, when you write a book and you hand it to somebody and it's thick, they go, whoa.
Yeah.
It's not the thickness of the book or the weight or the heft of the book. It's that you must have spent a whole, like, there's a built-in respect because you must have spent a bunch of time on this thing. And everything worth having is that way. And that's about all there is in life.
The books that you did always had to fit into your schedule. Like you were saying, you just had to chip away at those books every week, a certain amount of hours every week to get it done. Like, there was just no sane process where you sit down for 7 days straight, locked in a room, and write a book.
No,
there's too many things going on, right? You got to chip away at
what it. Every single loser I went to high school with never got, all the friends I had, never really got, is that life passes by really quickly. Those 52 weekends are going to come and go. You're going to blink your eyes, another year is going to go by. And if you just spent a couple hours on each one of those 52 weekends, it starts to add up pretty fast into tens or hundreds of hours of work. And you would have never even really felt it because it's just a couple hours. Like writing my books, I never even really felt it. I just get in the car, get on the phone, start dictating. It's not like there was what you feel. It's sort of like, you know, you're like a Navy SEAL team training, you know, they have to stay up for 4 days in a row or 3 days in a row or whatever it is that you remember, that you feel. If you just got up 15 minutes earlier than you normally get up twice a week for a year, you wouldn't feel that. It would add up at the end of the year to being up for four straight days, but you wouldn't feel it. Thank you, Max Pata, with a knowing and important nod. All right. Why don't we get Steve? I'm going to tell you about Amazon Automotive. Ah. Shopping for auto parts, tools, accessories, quickly, easily. Do it from your phone. Do it from your computer. Do it from your tablet. Plus, free shipping on millions of items for Prime members. Massive selection of parts, accessories, tools, fluids, even tires. Dr. Drew went to the dealer once and got tires for his car. It's like, are you nuts with the BMW over there? Top brands like K&N, Bilstein, Chemical Guys, Bosch, and more. All the good stuff. Use the customer Q&A and get product reviews, research. Buy the right part. Not an expert? That's fine. Check out Amazon's library of video content on Amazon.com. And how-to DIY. So it's amazon.com/how-to-DIY. Learn to install an air filter, change your oil, jump your dead battery, all the stuff a dude should
know. I get so many parts from Amazon. From Amazon. And because also their return policy is so good that when I get something that doesn't fit, it's very easy. I get the replacement part. It goes back. The other part goes back so easily. They're fantastic.
Amazon.com, get those parts. Steve Saline, good to see you, Steve.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm always happy to see you. We're always excited to talk about the products. Kind of, in a weird way, it's kind of weird seeing some of those S7s come up at auction now and stuff like that. It's making me feel old.
Actually, in a couple years, they will be eligible for vintage car racing, if you can believe that. So, but we just sent out our press release where we're delivering our first, we're doing a special run of seven more S7s.
In the, what's the power plant?
It's our power plant. We boost the horsepower. When we first introduced the S7, it was 550 horsepower. Then after I waited for Ferrari to come out with the Enzo, and then we raised it to 750, and then after a period of time, we raised to 1,000 horsepower, and these seven we announced just at the LA Car Show last week that they're 1,300 horsepower.
So you're bringing back the S7, but as a special Le Mans edition.
Yes, we are. And it's pretty exciting that I think most people have seen it. It does. The car has not aged at all.
It's a 427, like, small block Ford-based engine?
Well, it really is our own engine.
Okay.
It is what I would call a small block American V8.
Okay.
We did use the head gaskets on bore centers when it was designed for the cooling. But it really is our engine, our casting for the aluminum block, the heads, all aluminum. It is a push rod. Still shows the American V8. It still has it in it to make the horsepower. But it's a very compact engine. And because of that, our packaging with the S7 gave us an unusual advantage in racing on the weight transfer and distribution, which really helped overall on the balance of the car as well as the aerodynamics.
Now, if you're getting to 1,300 horsepower, there's probably a couple turbochargers on there?
Yes, we do have two turbochargers, and but it's really quite drivable.
And what kind of transmission are you guys using this now?
It's our own. We had to develop it. It's it is
expensive.
Old school in the respect that it's a 6-speed manual,
mm-hmm.
and has been, but we've had to do that because of the amount of torque. That it to keep the half shafts and everything
yeah.
strong enough internally.
So did when the car came out, it was a manual transmission, but now you're doing like a paddle shifted sequential?
No, we've kept it as all
it
a 6-speed manual. Yes, yeah,
oh,
we've never gone into it. The race version on this we went to your sequential.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now who raced the car? Was it? Did you guys campaign a car, or did other teams, like privateer teams, because the car had a lot of success
yes,
in
it,
racing.
It actually, if I can brag a little bit.
Go ahead.
It's the most successful supercar to date in the respect that the car has won at every major racetrack in the world with no exception. And I'm talking from Shanghai, China, Mount Fuji, Japan, Laguna Seca, Daytona, Sebring, Watkins Glen, Silverstone, England, Barcelona, Spain, Imola, Italy. In fact, I should tell you the story with Ferrari on that one. Nürburgring, Germany, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and we finally won the 24 Hours of Le Mans in our class a few years ago.
Well, let's brag about the Ferrari one.
Yeah, sure. Every time somebody talks about racing, somebody's like, "Oh, we've got a story about with Ferrari," because Ferrari is like they always sort of get people excited, irritated. I'm not sure what the right word is.
I don't know. They're obviously a very fierce competitor,
yeah.
and they always set a high benchmark. And we had – this was in the mid-2000s, and we had a number of customers. We did not have a factory team. Everyone that ran and purchased the Race S7R, as we called it, competed around the world in their own respect. And everyone not only won races, but every customer won a championship, at least one, during the 10 years that the car was eligible through the various series. In the particular case with the Ferrari, it was a FIA GT championship. It was at Imola, Italy. And it was between – this is when Michael Schumacher was driving for Ferrari. And Ferrari decided that they would show the new Maserati MC12 supercar, which was Enzo on steroids.
Right. Yeah.
And
open cockpit.
And they decided that at Imola, at their home track, that they would debut it. And they took their Formula One team, and John Todd was the Formula One team manager at the time. He brought everyone except for Michael Schumacher and the Formula One team to run two cars at Imola this weekend. And they had brought in all of the European journalists, flew them in, and they set up a three-wing circus tent that was like Circus de Soleil in the paddock area, I remember on this. And they had they brought in the famous Italian chefs for the full catering.
Yeah.
They had a supermodel runway show to entertain everyone. And they even had a full orchestra that was playing inside their tent this whole weekend. And As a contrast to it, we had a team from Germany that showed up in their Winnebago. They had their hibachi and their brats on the far end of the paddock area. And anyway, as it turned out, the day of the race, Luca de Montemozzolo, who was the head of Ferrari, and I would say next to the Pope, he was the second most popular person in Italy at the time, and he brought his whole entourage with him. And so we had our pits set up, and a Ferrari had qualified on the pole. We had a Celine S7 second, another Celine S7 third, another Ferrari, and then there was the two Maseratis were right together, and then the rest of the field. And this was live on Eurosport television. And the race started, and the Ferrari led for about a dozen laps. And then on cue, the German S7, came through for the lead. And on cue, both Maseratis came up onto it. And it was a long race. It was a six-hour endurance race. And I remember sitting there, we were in the pits, and we came into the last pit stop on this, and we're looking up in the corner of the TV, and we're watching live, and they're showing Luca live on, he's pounding on Mika Salo, who was number two driver at that time with Schumacher, and he's pounding on his chest, and you know what he's telling him, you're going to get in this car, and you need to win this damn race.
Yeah.
Right.
And so all three cars really came into the pit lane about the same time. We did a driver change, tire change and fuel up with the gas. And then I remember looking at pit lane, and they all peeled out and went down pit lane about the same time. And the S7 went on. Then it became a sprint race to the end. And the S7 went on. We lapped the one Maserati, and we finished 45 seconds in front of the second Maserati. And Luca then, after we won the race, and after that, Luca had to get up in front of all the press, all the Italian press, and tell them that they were no match for the Celine today.
Wow.
So,
what year was that?
That was, I'm going to say 2004. It would be...
We love the MC12. I said open cockpit earlier. I didn't mean it. It has this big intake over the cockpit, which I thought was really cool. It's actually... kind of the S7 and the MC12. The MC12 feels like a bulkier version of it, but the same kind of...
The S7's a big car. It's a architecture. Car. Yeah.
We have a question, by the way, from Chris from Eugene, Oregon, so I guess we can just ask Steve that. Chris?
Hey, guys.
Hey, you got a question for Steve?
I do, Steve. It's an honor to be on the phone with you. The S7 is one of my favorite cars of all time, let alone supercars. I mean, what you did with the shape and the long tail and having that car under 3,000 pounds and 750 horsepower with a 351 Windsor is pretty unbelievable. I'm hoping you can tell us maybe more about the early days of that car, the vision, the design process. Did you start with that engine? Did you consider other engines? And how you brought that car from the drawing board to life?
And also, Steve, you said that in a few years the race car is going to be eligible for vintage racing. What year were the race cars, and then when? I'm not sure. I do a little vintage racing. I'm not sure exactly what the rules are.
Typically it's 20 years is what I'm told to go back up to the Monterey Historic races. But we started. The S7 actually started out from our Mustang. I had taken one of our Mustangs through the years, through the 80s and the 90s, and we had raced them, obviously won a lot of championships throughout North America, and we went on a global tour with Tim Allen one year and took the cars over to Le Mans, raced at all of the European tracks with the Mustangs. But I felt that we had taken the Mustang as far as you could take it. We had stretched it. I had lowered it. We changed literally everything on the Mustang except the rear taillights. And some of the sports car racing, it still was not the right platform. So that was kind of the genesis for us saying, wow, maybe it'd be easier if we just started our own ground up design. And at the time this is 1999, the McLaren F1 was really kind of the benchmark that they had already established. And so that was kind of where we were looking at their benchmark and saying, okay, if we use some American ingenuity, how would we approach this? And we started with a clean sheet of paper, and I employed some an aerodynamicist that was with a Formula One team over in Europe at the time, and I felt that the decade of the 2000s aerodynamics would become a lot more important in the overall performance of the vehicle. And basically, we came up with our design, and then we went into the wind tunnel. We first started with a scale model, and I went to Europe for two reasons. One was to keep it quiet, because the track record for people doing their own cars and supercars with their name on it wasn't very good in the U.S.
Yeah.
And two, I wanted to immerse our racing activities with the technology that was available primarily from Formula One. And budget allowed to where I could go on, and we did the wind tunnel testing at the University of Glasgow in Scotland, had a small rolling plane wind tunnel that I could go on there for a good length of time. And we let the wind tunnel kind of determine, if you will, after we did our initial styling, the actual length, the height, and the width of the vehicle, and what was the most aerodynamic efficient that we could actually make. And then from there, we came back and did the packaging on how to actually do that. And that's what I was saying, is using a small block American V8 gave us an advantage, especially like over the Maserati, because using the 12-cylinder or the big, which was more of the European model, they had a lot of weight with the engine and transmission. We were able to make it very compact, put it in the dead center of the car, and were able to really package the airflow around it a lot more effective. And that was really kind of the genesis on this, is that I looked at, and everyone that was associated, we looked at what we could do to extract the most amount of performance and efficiency, not just in straight line. Everyone always measures 0 to 60 or quarter mile run. We were looking at what would give us the best straight line speed, but also the right aerodynamics so I could actually step on the brakes and pivot left or pivot right through a chicane or a sweeping corner. And so that was really how we established the S7.
How much easier, if it is it to start on a car today with all the computers and all the aids that, when you started the S7, it was still pretty much just whatever, how they did it 65 years before that. I mean, they didn't have wind tunnels, but I mean, you get some clay out and get some models and get some plywood bucks and stuff like that. I mean, is it just that much easier to do it now?
It has, in some respects, it's gotten easier from an overall design standpoint, from a legality standpoint with FMVSS requirements and everything else is probably more difficult. OBD2 requirements, tailpipe emissions, and all of that has gotten a lot more restrictive on doing that. I will say, though, with the S7, we were relatively small budget. And it was also in a hurry. So we kicked it off officially in December of 1999, and we showed the first car in 2000 at Pebble Beach in August of 2000.
Wow.
And then the first time the race car ran was two months following in October up at Laguna Seca. And
that's really fast turnaround.
And then the car competed in four championships with four different teams in 2001, and it won in all four championships its first full year of racing.
How many S7s were made?
We, not counting the 8, we've made just a little under 100. We'll probably be right at 100 total S7s with the remaining 7 that we're doing.
That includes the race cars?
Yes, that includes. There was 14 race cars out of that went to various teams over the course of its run.
Yeah. Are they all silver?
No.
No, the race cars were like red, white, and blue.
No, the street cars we keep seeing that look great.
Wait,
there's
haven't
just
I
a
seen
lot of
some in like an orange, a Lamborghini orange?
And a red?
We call it beryllium.
Beryllium.
Sorry, which is copper, but it is.
And there's like a darker red, I think I've seen.
Yeah. We offered eight colors, and there's an S7, at least one each in all eight colors. So we have a candy apple red that we call Lizstick Red, which is named after my wife, Liz. And then we have the what we call Chrome Molly Silver, which is named after my daughter, Molly. And the other colors are, we have, you know, Speed Lab Yellow and all of the other colors as well.
Yeah.
The special edition, Le Mans editions, all of those are the Chrome Moly Silver with a candy black, but we have it to where you can see the full carbon fiber body underneath the black, which is really a pretty, when you're out in the sun, it really is a pretty cool looking aspect of the car.
Yeah, doing carbon fiber bodies of that size and scale in that day in 99, 2000, They're expensive. Carbon isn't quite like it is today.
It's more expensive today than it was. The one thing I was going to say is that we did not, unlike a lot of the companies, we did pencil sketches, and then we were probably one of the first to put the whole design in CAD, and we never did a full model. We did a scale model cutout of 1/5 scale in CAD. And once we approved that, and then after the wind tunnel testing, we went directly to final molds rather than go through all of the stuff that you see today sometimes in either clay or full scale.
You said it's more expensive now to do the body?
Yeah, the body back in the early 2000s, our cost on the carbon fiber, and this is, again, this is the best carbon fiber you can buy, laid up in vacuum bagged and then put into autoclave for cooked under pressure and heat for whatever period of time. And our cost has gone way up. Back there, we paid, just the body alone was over $100,000. And today, it's another 20 or 30% higher than that when we started.
Wow, I thought it would
go down by now.
Well, I remember talking to the McLaren guys about building the tub for their car, and they're like, the first one took cost $100,000 and took 200 man hours, and this one cost $18,000 and took 9 man hours or something. I thought, oh, so it's gone down. But that was the McLaren tub. I don't know.
I guess if you're making 7 of them, they're
expensive. Yeah, on a very limited run, it is very expensive because each one is done by hand.
Right. Conversely, so if you're doing 1,000 units, it'd be cheap.
Yeah. So conversely, we're doing carbon fiber body on the new car we showed at the LA Auto Show, the Celine S1. Mm-hmm. And that's a full carbon body too. And we're selling the whole car for $100,000. So your scale and the type of tooling that you use ends up being very important in the overall costing as well.
I got to see a picture of that S1, which I have not seen. It's a 2.5 turbo I'm looking at here, 450 horsepower. I love the fact that everyone's going down in displacement and cylinders and cranking up the horsepower, and it feels very European to me. Oh, yeah, we did look at this car. Let me tell you, and we'll get into the S1 in a second. Let me tell you about Simply Safe first. Think about some home security this year. You better think about Simply Safe. I worked with them. I put together a security arsenal, and I did it just for you. I got a special package handpicked by me. Entry, motion, glass break sensors, everything you need. And right now, for the holidays, my friends at Simply Safe are giving my listeners $200 off of this package. Coming into 2018, people, let's protect our things. No contracts, no commitments, no long-term lock-in, anything. Go to Simply Safe right now. Simply Safe, you get the $200 off of my custom package, Simply Safe, twoeyesinthere.com/Adam3. SimplySafe.com, Adam. Sorry, simplysafe.com/Adam3. That's T-H-R-E-E. Get the $200 savings, man, in my special package. So the S1, let's talk about
Yeah,
that.
Tell us about that. How did this come about?
Well, this is at the opposite end of the spectrum, but we still wanted to have a little different take to where I felt that we could actually design and build an affordable car that a lot of people, not that $100,000 is still, you know, affordable, but in this spectrum, it certainly is a lot different than I think what people expected to see from us.
How many units do you reckon you'll be doing?
We're looking at doing about 1,500 units a year, which is the same as I did when we had the Ford GT program for Ford. That's basically 8 a day on one shift. So the structure that you put in the manufacturing would be very similar.
Now, you're partnering up with a Chinese company on this. What's the involvement with that? How does that break down?
Well, there was some preemptive news out of China. We're actually doing a television show, a reality TV show in China.
Okay.
And the S1 is actually one of the stars in the show. So they had a special event that they were involved with on branding, and they showed the S1, and then people in China took and kind of filled in a lot of gaps that were not given on that, and so then that kind of got us into that. We have partnered with a Chinese company. It's called Jiangsu Saline Automotive Technology. We've licensed our use of our name to a startup car company in China, and what they wanted to do was have kind of an entry level sports car. And in doing that, about a year ago, maybe a little over a year ago, they had purchased, unbeknownst to me, had purchased the remnants of a car company out of Germany called the Artega.
Yeah.
And in doing that, they had got me involved about a year ago and said, hey, we want you to just do kind of a modification and bring it to, up to speed. After looking at it not too long, we realized that it was really too old and really would not meet any of today's standards. Technology had moved on dramatically. All of crash and occupant safety and tailpipe emissions, all of that would have to be redone. So we decided to discard that and still keep with the same model as a small sports car. With what I call supercar credentials, and redo a ground up, which is what you see with the S1.
You got a 2.5 Ford motor in there?
No, it again.
You're tired of everyone asking
this
you that?
Came out from from China. So we've established our own 2.5 inline four. It's a turbocharged motor. Has a different head configuration than what you've seen on this, and it allows us to boost it to get 450 horsepower in a very light package.
Overhead. Where are you going to make it?
Everything Camp. Has been designed and engineered at our headquarters in Southern California here in Corona,
okay.
And the manufacturing will all be done too. At some point in time in the future, then the plant that they're setting up in China will go ahead and build. The plan is that they will build some for the Asian market, but we'll continue to service North America.
The engine
here.
Or the car?
Pardon?
The engine or the car?
Both.
So you're going to build the S1s here for the U.S., and they're going to build them there for the China.
Yeah, but it'll be probably a year and a half before you see China has their facility up to be able to do that.
Yeah.
The motor. So describe the motor to us, because I'm, you know, some of the Datsuns. For instance, I was driving me nuts. They put the intake and the exhaust on the same side. It's hard for me to get the headers off.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and then some swap it and have the intake on one side and the exhaust on the other. Some are single cam, four cam, or two cam, you know, push rod. They're all different. What is the general architecture of the engine?
Well, it's similar to today's. It's a direct injected engine on it. It's it really is a much more modern engine in the respect that we're not using push rods, and it's a very compact four cylinder. I would say, other than the push rod on this, it really is more, if you would think, if we took half of a V8,
mm-hmm.
And be specific, a 302 V8, and kind of took all the good things out of it and ran the type of bolts and stuff so we can run more pressure through the, you know, the head gaskets, and we can put more pressure into the cylinder and still have good durability has been part of that aspect. And then the intake system we designed with the car. So on the car, you see where it has some intake on the side. So on one side, that's your intake that's coming in through the engine. And the other one is for part of the air cooling for the intercooler. It's an air-to-air intercooler.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I will say the intercooler by itself probably is bigger than most radiators. It takes up almost, in this case, a full trunk.
So single overhead cam?
Yes.
And running a chain. Is everyone running a chain these days?
Yeah.
We're all back to chains?
Yeah, I don't think you're running too many gears
anymore. I don't like
those.
Well, belt. I was thinking about belts versus chains. But we got away from the belts, which is good. We don't have to replace them as often. And how many pounds of boost do you need to get?
Well, we haven't actually finalized that yet, but you have to be in the 18 to get that kind of power. You have to be in the 18 to 20.
Is it all... Now, with the pre-detonation stuff and the computer and the retard in advance, you know, back in the day, they do like water injection and stuff, you know, just to stop all the pre-detonation. Now I feel like the computer will allow you to really turn that boost up and not have the pre-detonation.
It's actually two combinations. With the advancement in electronics has been unbelievable. So your fuel spark, which is what all of the major manufacturers have been pushing, and that some of the technology to get better fuel economy is what has driven this. But going also into direct injection, which is primarily initially was for better fuel economy, now has turned into where when you make an engine more efficient, you get more power as well.
Yeah.
And as everything is like racing, is you're always trying to optimize the efficiency of the total vehicle. And in the engine particular is that efficiency with the direct injection with the new electronics and what can be done to control the fuel spark aspect of it has really helped a lot in both the power, drivability, and tailpipe emissions at the same time.
I'm trying to – I have a vintage racing question for you. I know Tim Allen a little bit, and I've talked to him about racing those Mustangs. And I'm thinking – and Matt, you can help me out on this. You know, when we go do a lot of these vintage races, we do see some Roush stuff and some Mercury stuff and some Capri stuff and some Ford stuff. But I can't think of the Saline stuff. Saline, sorry.
Yeah.
Can you? Is there stuff out there? Is it getting out there?
Yes, it is. We did not – a lot of the – in Adam, you in particular are into the Trans Am aspect of it. I ran in two separate areas. I ran a Saline Mustang in the Trans Am series. But mm-hmm. we concentrated more on the World Challenge series, mm-hmm. which is, again, would be in a different category than what you're seeing in the typical groups that you're running into it. But there are a number of ones. I had the opportunity to go to drive our winning car from Mossport in 1986 at Mid-Ohio. And that brought up back a lot of memories in doing that in our 87 Mustang. So they are running, but it typically is in a different class than what you've been competing in Trans Am cars.
I think specifically you're talking about like walking around at Monterey for the Rolex Historics and you know, when do we start to see, you know, Saline race cars show up?
Well, we're going to see the S7 coming up.
Yeah.
In
a couple of years.
In a couple of years. Oh, we're looking, yeah, right. So is that the 86 we're looking at a picture of?
That's one there? Yeah, that picture that we have is our 87 Saline Mustang.
So, right.
And that would qualify for the 20-year rule now. So.
No, but you're right in that the guys aren't going to go out there with that car, with the big slick cars,
right.
The 850 horsepower stuff, like the crazy tube frame modified whatever.
Yeah, these are not tube frame. These are real cars.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
They were closer to the original Trans Am cars, actually. And we went down that road because I felt to improve our breed and improve what we did for the street that this had a much more direct correlation on doing that.
Well, you know, we have Datsun Z cars that don't have any Datsun Z anything.
They don't. Yeah, there's a car that I drove at Mid-Ohio last year.
They don't seem like Z cars at all. Full tube frame. You got some business
there? Yeah, well, I got a couple questions about the company, too. But first, let me tell you guys about Geico. You know, everybody's got a to-do list. You drop off your dry cleaning, you pick up some milk, and now you can save hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, and you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. You can just go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could easily be saving 15% or more on your car insurance. So if you want some extra money in your pocket, you can do a little shopping, some car parts for the holidays. You know, this is the most rewarding to-do you can do today. Go to geico.com.
All right. So as we turn the corner and bring it on home, questions.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch base on, you know, been such a fan of you and the Saline Mustangs for so long, being a Fox Body Mustang guy. The company looks like it's had some up and downs over the years with the economy and things like that. Tell us the quick story. What happened with Saline, and then you started SMS, and now you've got Saline back, and now we have a public company, and we can clearly see where we are financially. What's the future of it? What happened there, and what's the future of it?
We're almost 35 years into this, and we've produced cars every single year.
A lot of cars over 35.
Yeah, we're approaching 30,000 Saline vehicles on the road.
Did you guys do a rent-a-racer program back in the day?
We even had to rent a car from Budget Rental Car as well. Yeah. So we've kind of covered all of the aspects of it. But I started the company off of our dining room table. The kitchen table wasn't big enough, so I started in 83 off the dining room table. And over the years, we went through and we built the company up, and we got to the point where the end of 2003, 2004, I had the opportunity to sell the company. And so I kind of debated, do I not? And I decided that I would go ahead. And I sold the company to a private investment group in the tail end of 2003, beginning of 2004. And unfortunately, like some of these go, is that the honeymoon was fine for about a couple years. We were still doing the Ford GT program. And towards the tail end of that, we had a disagreement as to the direction of the company. And I was no longer, you know, the shareholder, major shareholder of the company. So obviously my opinion didn't count for as much. And so in 2007, I decided that the decisions that they were making, I didn't feel that the company would survive. And I resigned. I just quit. I know you read the internet and all this stuff wrong. Oh, I was forced out or no. No, I realized that the decisions that they were making were not correct, and the company, I felt, would not survive. So I resigned in spring of 2007. And about a year later, sure enough, they ended up closing their doors. Then what happened was that I spent the next 5.5 years through the legal system arguing on who owned the name Saline and all the IP. And in 2013, I finally won that case through the courts. And then I had to restart the company. And so we decided, I was kind of burned out on raising capital from the private equity group. So we suggested I could go in and into the public domain and raise some capital. So we went ahead and did that. And it's been an interesting ride in that is we've been traded on penny stocks. It certainly, I don't feel, is an indication of the worth of the company on doing that. We have recently, though, we have delisted on this as I've regrouped everything here because, again, we announced the fact that it's a restart, so I have to raise capital to get us up to where we're going. But everyone thinks that that's a major weakness of what you're doing as a company. And so we decided that, you know, we'll be dark here for a period of time on this deal as we are expanding. But I will tell you that from a financial standpoint, things are moving along really pretty good. Obviously, we're bringing out new cars, new products. I drove up today in our 30th anniversary of our first race win, our championship.
Yeah, I like that car.
In the Mustangs. And things are moving where they're supposed to.
And are you back to doing the Mustangs and the one-off, the supercars, or are you still working on your relationship with Dodge and GM as well?
I'm concentrating more on the Ford side of the business, on what we call the Saleem signature car side. So we've shown our 2018 Saleem Mustang. We also announced, and you'll see at Barrett-Jackson next month, you'll see our Saleem F-150 sport truck live and in person. We just came out 2 months ago when we're delivering our 30th anniversary Saleem Mustangs from our race car days. And we just showed a brand new sports car, the Saleem S1, here, and we've just delivered our first of the seven of the S7. So from a productivity standpoint, I'd say we're really hitting on all eight cylinders.
Good.
Well, good.
I like that. I'll see you at Barrett-Jackson, too. I'm going to go check out the truck.
I like to live in a world where Saleem is out there and has products. Actually, I feel that way about the Super Bowl. I like seeing the Patriots and the Giants, like the Dodgers and the Yankees. I just like those names out there.
Yeah.
I like that Saleem's out there. And I like that Amazon's out there, man. We get so many. I mean, so many of the parts Matt gets for the Mustang are off Amazon. I get everything off Amazon, too. It's easy. You get parts, you get tools, you get accessories, you get all the, microfiber rags, whatever it is you want. And you get the free shipping on millions of items for the Prime members. Massive selection of parts, accessories, tools, fluids, even tires. I didn't know you could get tires from Amazon. Makes sense.
I just got windshield wipers.
You just got windshield wipers.
It's going to be raining soon.
You get top brands like K&N, Bilstein, Chemical Guys, Bosch, and more. So, tired of looking at part numbers and reading catalogs, Amazon's all you need. You just put the year, the make, the model, it all comes up there. Very computerized, very easy, user-friendly. Use the customer Q&A and product reviews, and you make sure you buy the right part. And they have do-it-yourself stuff and videos and everything like that. So go to Amazon.com/vehicles, and you can find reviews, specs, images, everything else. And hundreds of thousands of new and classic cars as well. The parts, it's all out there. Go to Amazon.com/vehicles, and you can find all the specs and all the images and all the stuff you want. All right, let's see. If you want to get our movies, we got a lot of good car movies coming out. Some are already out. Go to Chassis, 2SsAnY.com. And me and Mike August in Irvine, that's January 25th. We're doing basic cable commentary. That's Cobra. Lynette's running Corolla Drinks. So go to CorollaDrinks.com and check out Shift and Steer. You can listen to that at Podcast One as well. Steve, we should send people to the website, Saleem, Saleem.com. Just go there to find out any products or whatever they want to put an order in.
Yeah, or give us a call, and we certainly would like to talk. We'll be at, again, a lot of the major car shows around the country. We'll be at the next one is Barrett-Jackson.
Man.
I would like to say one thing, though, Adam, is I know you're a great history buff, and looking around your shop here, I look at some of the pictures you had here with Paul Newman. I would like to tell you one of my little stories, if
Please.
I can, is that when I was a teenager, I was in the cars, and I was part of the Mustang Club, and we were the host club. We were actually part of the safety crew, the patrol safety crew at Ontario Motor Speedway here in Southern California. And they had a race there. It was called the Questor Grand Prix, and that was the Indy cars against the Formula One cars. And they had all the top drivers from Formula One in the day and all the top drivers in IndyCar. And they had the way it was laid out, they had the garage, or the inside pits were on the inside of the track, and you had the grandstands on the outside of the track. And they had a tunnel that came under it. And I was in charge of policing between the Ferrari and the BRM team on the, where the tunnel came up on the stairway. And during practice on the deal, I had to make sure people weren't smoking in the pits for the refueling and obviously drinking alcoholic beverages. So I'm there during the practice, and up through the tunnel comes up the stairway is two gentlemen that I had to stop, and that was Steve McQueen and Paul Newman.
Wow!
And
what year is this?
They had their beer.
Of course.
So I had to stop them both and say, "Hey guys, we need to put this in on doing it." And
what year is this?
It had to be 1969, 1970, in that time frame. And and so that was my encounter with Steve McQueen. But Paul Newman, I raced against numerous times. I know you've done the story on his life on doing it. And I would always joke with him at the races. I said, you know, you probably don't remember, but I was the one that stopped you and McQueen for coming in the pits on doing that and all of that. So we always got a bit of a laugh out of that one. So I thought you would appreciate that
beer
Paul
police.
Newman story.
Beer police.
The beer
Steve
police.
Celine. All right, so go to Celine.com. And yes, we do appreciate any of those stories. And one of the good part about making one of these movies is everyone shares a story from back in the day,
story.
A genuine story. So, until next time, it's Adam Kroll for Steve Celine and Matt, the moderator, DeAndrea, saying keep the air in the spare and the bag in the wheel.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.